Hello, and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, we have a brand new affiliate. Welcome, KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California. While Nonprofit Radio was on the road past 2.5 weeks, I stopped by Davis. I met program director Jeff, the executive director Autumn. I toured the studio. And I thank you very much for hosting me, Jeff and Autumn. And this is the California announcement that I've been teasing you about. And there will be another California affiliate coming. But for today, welcome KDRT Davis. So very glad you're with us, our newest affiliate. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd bear the pain of encephalomyeloradiculitis if I had to think about the mere idea of you missing today's show. Smart donor engagement. Compare what you're doing with takeaways from Abila's study of how donors want to be engaged and how nonprofits actually engage them. Some methods are on target, others miss. Rich Dietz is Abila's director of fundraising strategy. Also, the right database. What are the steps to select the right database for your organization? Michelle Chaplin is senior manager of online fundraising at PBS. We talked at NTC, the Nonprofit Technology Conference, hosted by NTEN, the Nonprofit Technology Network. On Tony's Take Two, a tribute to Rochelle Charette. We're sponsored by Opportunity Collaboration, that working meeting, that unconference on poverty reduction that will ruin you for every other conference. I'm very glad to welcome Rich Dietz. He is Director of Fundraising Strategy at Abila. He began his nonprofit career as director of a youth mentoring program in college. For 20 years, he's been working in and with a wide variety of nonprofit, political, and government organizations, as well as tech companies focused on the nonprofit sector. The company is at abila.com, and he is at Rich Dietz on Twitter. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Tony. Glad to be here.
Pleasure. I'm very glad that you are. Where are you calling from?
Calling from Austin, Texas.
You're in Austin. All right. Austin is awesome. We just had NTC there, the Nonprofit Technology Conference. Were you there?
I was definitely there. It was right in our backyard, and I actually found it harder to go to the conference when it was in my own backyard than when traveling, because I had to drive in every day in Austin traffic, which
I
was
see.
Not fun.
I'm sorry we didn't meet there, though. But I met Abila there, but I didn't see you personally. But next year, you're going to be there, you think, in 2016?
Most definitely.
Okay, that's San Jose, I believe, isn't it?
Yes, I'm very excited to be back in California. I'm from California originally.
I lived
in the Bay Area for quite a few years, and so I'm very excited to go back.
I just spent a week at Half Moon Bay.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, it's very nice, right on the coast. Very, very nice community. Okay, Rich, this donor engagement study, why do we need such a study?
Well, we did this study for a couple of reasons. One, we were looking at the industry, and we saw a bunch of other studies out there that talked to donors or maybe talked to organizations and was trying to get at this whole idea of why donors give, you know, what motivates them to give, what makes them feel engaged. And we found that there was a lot of studies that looked at one or the other, but there weren't studies that looked at both groups as a whole and then compared them to see if there was any differences, overlap, commonalities, or actually holes in that. And some of our concerns around that was, you know, 57% of donors each year are leaving organizations, you know, donor attrition. You know, we also see 74% of nonprofits admit that they don't use donor data to make program decisions. And that sort of, you know, concerns us a little bit. So we wanted to dig a little bit deeper into that. So we created the study, the donor engagement study. It was a survey of both donors as well as nonprofit organizations. We asked them a number of questions to find out preferences on engagement. So we asked the nonprofits, how do you think donors want to be engaged with? And then we asked the donors, how do you actually want to be engaged with? And then compared those and found some really interesting commonalities and some very, very interesting differences.
That attrition rate that you mentioned, that we've had the other guests mention that 74 or 75% of donors leave an organization each year. That's startling.
It is startling and striking, and the way I usually tell people how startling it is let's say you had 100 donors donate today. In 5 years, only one of those donors is still donating to your organization. That should scare you, and that should keep you up at night.
99% over 5 years?
Well, no. I'm saying it's year over year, 74% or 70%.
Okay.
And so every year you're losing. Yes, yeah. So after 5 years, only one of those 100 is still donating.
Okay, so we could call that 99% attrition over 5 years.
Over five, yeah.
My gosh, yeah. All right, I never thought about it longer than. Okay. And how did you select the nonprofits and donors to survey?
We actually went through a research firm called Edge Research just to make sure that we weren't biased and how we didn't want to just select our clients or just not our clients. So we went through a research company called Edge Research, and they did it all using, you know, the highest statistical standards, 95% plus confidence, all of that fancy stuff that I don't understand everything about. But, you know, I leave that for the smarter people.
Okay. Confidence intervals. I remember those. Confidence from college statistics.
Yeah.
Like if you had 96% confidence, that's actually not very good. As I recall from,
right. Well, I'm not sure what the exact confidence was.
No,
but,
I know. No, and no, I'm saying
I can always go back and look.
No, I didn't mean if this study had 96%. I mean, in general, if one has 96% confidence, as I recall from college statistics, that's not even very high. You want to be like 98 or 99%.
If you can.
Don't worry. I'm not impugning the Abila study. We haven't gotten into it yet. There's nothing to impugn. All right. So you have some excellent takeaways, which we want to leave listeners with. Remember, our audience is small and mid-sized nonprofits, and they are certainly struggling with that kind of attrition. And we're interested in the commonalities, but also the misalignments and the disconnects between what donors are saying they would like or believe they've got and what nonprofits believe they are doing or believe they ought to do. So that's where we want to kind of focus on these. Your first takeaway is that basics and fundamentals are very, very important.
Most definitely, and this is one of the findings I was very excited about, because I've been preaching the fundamentals and getting back to the basics for many, many years as I've been consulting and teaching and training across the way. In fact, I have a master's in social work, so I'm a social worker by trade. And something we learn about in social work school is Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which I'm sure most people on the call are very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And Maslow's hierarchy of needs says, you know, you have to have your basic needs met before you can move up into higher level things. So you have to have food and water before you even care about friendship or, you know, confidence or anything like that. And what I found working with nonprofits is it was very similar in that they need to focus on the basics first and then move up the ladder there. And so what I mean by that is you need to focus on your website, email marketing, your donor process, you know, how you move a donor from an email all the way through the donation process to actually becoming a donor. And you need to focus on that first before you get into things like peer-to-peer fundraising and social media and all of that stuff. And so what we found in the study is going back and really focusing on those fundamentals. And what do we mean by those fundamentals? The number one thing is thinking through that donor flow, thinking through what it is like to be a donor, to go through your entire process of a fundraising campaign. And that is from that email they receive, to the link they click on, to the page they land on, to the donation form, and all the way through the thank you, and then of course the follow-up. And the follow-up is so important. And so the way we've been kind of talking about now, instead of thinking of a holistic donor experience, we're calling it a holistic donor experience, because you not only need to think about the entire process, but also the actual individual that is going through that process. And we're going to get much deeper into this when we get into the segmentation, but thinking about who's doing it. Is it a major donor? Is it a major donor who likes polar bears? And that gives you a very different process that you may want to do than a $50 donor who likes red-eyed tree frogs. And we'll get much more into that as we go through.
And
another really important thing on the fundamentals is showing impact. You've probably heard other people talk about how important it is to show impact and that the work that you're doing is meaningful and making a difference. Well, in our survey, we found that the number one thing donors wanted to know about was, is the money being used wisely? They also wanted to know if their support is making a difference was another top three concern of theirs. And so by showing the impact, you can do that. The best way to show that impact, of course, is stories. Stories are going to be the best way to show that impact. And that's, yeah, again, going back to the basics, really crafting some beautiful stories. And if you can, bring in that visual storytelling. And what we mean by that is using video, using pictures to really tell a great story.
Okay, Rich.
A great study done by, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes. I wanted to point out that, going back a little bit, your premise was that people started that pipeline through an email, but there actually may be multiple ways. They may have found you first on one of the social networks, or they may have found you first through hearing about you from a friend. So even just that entry into the pipeline is going to vary across people.
Definitely. And channel preference is something that we'll be talking about in some of the later findings as well. But that's a great point, is actually tailoring how they found you in that messaging and in those stories, and how you communicate with them is also very important. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Thanks, Rich. We need to take a break. And when we come back, of course, you and I will keep talking about Abila's donor engagement study. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
What are the latest travel trends? How can travel be a part of your overall health and wellness plan? This is William Paris, lifestyle travel consultant and your host on Travel and Wellness Today. Join me on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time for travel chat, travel tips, and travel news updates. That's on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
TalkingAlternative.com.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. I can't send live listener love by city and state today because we're pre-recorded by a day. It's a day before the live show. But, of course, live listener love to each person who is, in fact, listening live. Podcast pleasantries to those over 10,000 listening in the time shift, wherever it is, whatever device, whatever you're doing, maybe washing dishes. That was the latest I've heard. Podcast pleasantries to everybody in the podcast and listening that way, and our affiliate affections. Love our affiliates, those AM and FM and online stations throughout the country. Whatever day, whatever time, they play it and their schedule. Affections to all our affiliate listeners, and of course, KDRT being our newest affiliate in Davis. Rich, are you from Davis or Davis area by any chance? You said
I am not. I was from Redondo Beach, California, down south, but I lived in San Francisco for about 7 years.
Okay, yeah, you did mention Bay Area. Okay. All right. So, moving on, we have some disconnect between donors and nonprofits around frequency of communication.
Yeah, and this was one of the more controversial aspects of the study. We had a couple of people come up to this on this. We actually had somebody accuse us of malpractice, quote unquote, talking about communication frequency, and I think they read it slightly wrong. So what we found is nonprofit professionals were 10 times more likely than donors to feel that they were not communicating enough. So the organizations felt they should be communicating more. Yeah. The donors were saying, you're doing it just about right. So there was a disconnect there. So some folks thought we were saying, don't communicate as much, don't email as much, don't do as many Facebook posts. And that's not really what we're saying. What we're saying is actually bringing in the next key finding with this one is critical content is more important than frequency or channel. So what we're saying is it's not how much you communicate, it's how you're communicating. One is communicating with really good content. So that is giving them the stories, the thank yous, showing the impact, the accomplishments that you've made. That's the content that they want. That's the content that they don't mind if you email more of it. The other thing is to customize your content. You're now, nonprofits are now being compared to Amazon and Zappos and these for-profits who are really customizing and tailoring their content. And donors are at home going, well, if Amazon knows that I like books about weaving, why can't my nonprofit know what I'm interested in about their organization? Why don't they know that I'm interested in the Girls After School program? How come they can't tailor that content? So we're saying better content and a little more tailored to the individual donor.
You have some findings on different channels that donors would like to see frequency managed differently on.
Yes, definitely. And that was some of the interesting findings as well. There was definitely some surprises in there and some things that we had come to expect. Is there any particular ones that you're interested in, Tony?
Yeah, well, let's start with email. What did donors feel about the email channel?
What I found about email, what I was actually very happy to see and something I've been preaching for a while, is that email is actually pretty solid across all groups. And we also, at Abilla, we also slice the data by generation. So we slice it out by millennials, Gen Xers, boomers, and matures. And what we found is something like email was actually solid across all of those generations. In fact, the matures, which are, 65 and over, 69% of them said that email was a fine way to communicate with them. So when people say that the older folks aren't on email or they don't like getting their email, we're definitely seeing a shift change there.
Yeah, I don't agree with that, that matures or olders, however, boomers, matures don't like email. I think in a lot of cases, the individual would have given their email address to the organization. So you're expressing your preference for that channel that way.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
What about direct mail, U.S. paper mail? What your findings on that?
Yeah, there's actually interesting finding on that, and I definitely want to dig deeper into this. But we found that, of course, you would expect boomers and matures, about 80% of them are saying direct mail is fine. A finding that was a little surprising is millennials, 84% of them said direct mail is fine. And my running theory right now, I don't have any evidence to back this up yet, but that millennials aren't getting a lot of mail, so getting something in the mail is kind of a cool thing for them.
Oh,
you know
okay.
what I mean? So maybe direct mail might work with millennials.
Okay.
It's going to be something that has to be looked at a little deeper.
I see why you were chuckling when I asked you about that.
Yeah.
All right. They're not getting enough. those J. Crew catalogs and the American Apparel catalogs are just not sufficient.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Interesting. And then, all right, so then sort of related to that is that people do want content that they believe that is relevant to them.
Most definitely. And it really gets into the segmentation.
Yes. Okay. And we're going to get to segmentation. I guess, all right, we can, it does not have to be in the sequence that you and I have been thinking about since we've teased it a couple times. Now, what do we know about segmentation? It's not really being done quite as well as it ought to be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you talk to nonprofits, they're probably pretty honest about this. In fact, 52% of nonprofits felt like they really weren't using segmentation as well as they could. And we found, not surprisingly, 52% of donors felt like organizations weren't taking their preferences into account. And so when I talk about segmentation, that's what I'm really talking about is donor preferences, is how can you build an experience that the donor feels that you have taken their preferences into account, that you have taken their interests into account. Remember, like I said earlier, nonprofits are being compared to Amazon and Zappos and all of that now. So they're getting highly segmented in some of their emails and some of their communications that they're getting, and they're not being segmented and talked to in a very specific way from the nonprofits. So we really need to do a better job at that. Now, what we found is most nonprofits felt that they were using donation amounts as a source of segmentation, but it really dropped off drastically when we started looking at other ways to segment. And so what I like to suggest to my nonprofits is to start with donation amount, because you're already doing that, and then try to add in one or two more other data points. A really easy one to do would be interest. What are they interested in? What have they shown any sort of interest in? And a lot of nonprofits have this data already on hand, and they might not even know about it. You can go to your email marketing software and look at what links did they click on. Did they click on a link for the Girls After School program? Then they're probably interested in women's issues, girls' issues, or maybe they even have girls. Did they click on red-eyed tree frogs and they didn't click on polar bears? So you can actually pull out some of that interest data. So they're telling you in many ways, and then you can segment further down from there.
Okay, so we've talked about age and interest, communications channels. What else? We mentioned giving amount. That's very standard. That seems a very, very, very standard method of segmenting. What else can you recommend?
Another interesting one to think about is location. And I think this one is particularly good for national organizations that are fundraising or doing things across the country. And the best example that I've seen of this in recent years has been the Obama campaign. During the last Obama campaign, there was a New York Times reporter, I believe, that did an interesting study where he went and he signed up for all the candidates' emails, but he signed up from different parts of the country. And so for the Obama campaign, when he signed up in Portland, Oregon, he got very different emails than when he signed up in South Carolina. In Portland, Oregon, he got emails about forestry, about labor issues. Down in South Carolina, he got very different communication. So just by the location that somebody is at that they signed up for, you can actually start segmenting based on that and making educated guesses on what their interests might be. And then you look at your email statistics. If they continue to click on those things that you think they're interested in, then yes, they are. If not, then you can try something else.
Signing up from Portland, I would add Thai food should be added to that interest because I had the most delicious.
For some reason, unicycles are really big in Portland.
Oh, are they? Oh, I didn't see that, but I didn't see any unicyclists. I missed that, but I had the most delicious U.S. Thai food that I've had since I've been to Thailand, and I live in New York City, and supposedly we have good restaurants here. But I have to shout since you mentioned Portland, Pok Pok is P-O-K-P-O-K, best Thai food I've had. It was in Portland, best U.S. Thai I've ever had. So I would add Thai food to the forestry interests in Portland. What about age? Now, Rich, if we don't have age in our database, what are we gonna? How do we get at that?
That is an interesting one, and that one's going to be a little bit of a challenge. But I have some ideas that I think might help folks out. So age is an important one, and we really do want to highlight the age. Since we did look at this data and we did, Adabilla, we sliced it up into the different age groups, millennials, Gen Xers, matures, baby boomers, and all that stuff. We found that only 3% of nonprofits said that they're really looking at age on a frequent basis in order to segment. And we saw, as you saw on the channel preference and all that, there are some big differences in there. So when you're looking at age, I think there's some ways you can get this data. Some of this data nonprofits may already have. If a nonprofit has done a walk or a ride or a run or any sort of event like that, they probably ask for age in order to put them into their age brackets. And so that can help get that data right there. Look at any of your past registrations and see if you have that age data. It could already be there. The other thing is to do a donor survey. And there's a lot of good reasons to do a donor survey, not just for age, but to actually get into your preferences. I say all the time that, when we talk about best practices, a best practice is really just a starting point. You still need to test it and try it out within your organization because you might have very different donor segments than what we're talking about here. And so by doing a donor survey, you can dig deeper into what their preference. You can ask them their channel preference. You can ask them, how they want to be communicated with, how frequently they want to be communicated, whatever you want to do in there. Now, the big problem with surveys is getting people to turn them in. So you got to come up with some incentives for them to turn in those surveys. You can obviously give away some tchotchkes, a T-shirt or a bumper sticker or, a discount to your gal or something like that. But a new idea that I'm seeing a few start to experiment with now is doing some sort of matching grants or matching gift with surveys. So get one of your major donors to say, hey, anyone who turns in the donor survey, I'm going to donate $1 to the organization. And letting the donors know why you're asking for this data. The reason you're asking for the data is so you can communicate with them in the way that they want to be communicated with. Letting them know that that they're overwhelmed with emails and overwhelmed with direct mail and all that stuff, and you only want to be sending them the communications that they actually want. So that would be their incentive for filling it out as well.
I love that donor contribution match for each survey. We have a donor who will donate a certain dollar amount. That's outstanding. That's a cool idea. I haven't heard that. Excellent. Any other suggestions about getting at age for an organization that doesn't have it? If not, we can move on. Anything else you got?
Yeah. You know, that, I mean, that I think is something that's going to develop over the next 6 to 10 months. If any listeners out there come up with some good ideas, please send them in, send them our way, because I'm looking for new things to test and try. And if I find new ones, I will let you know as well.
Okay. And I'll remind listeners that you are at Rich Dietz, D-I-E-T-Z, at Rich Dietz on Twitter. Okay, let's move on then. Some other takeaways. People love giving, right? Makes them feel very good.
It actually makes them feel very good. And this is one of the interesting ones, is the number one way that they felt engaged and connected to an organization was through the act of giving. Volunteering came in a fairly close second, and attending events and doing things like that, really it fell off dramatically from there. People felt like attending an event wasn't as engaging as, you know, volunteering or actually donating. And on the surface, you're like, okay, that is totally obvious, right? But there's a couple key points here. One, I try to use this to help nonprofits feel more comfortable in asking for money. People want to donate, and when they do, they feel really, really good. So you're actually helping people to feel good. So you're doing a service for them. You're not taking their money. You're giving them good feelings is the way I like to tell my nonprofit that I work with.
Very good. Very good. Love that. Okay. And you have there's a difference among millennials. The one and two are swapped.
Yes, it is, and that was really interesting for us. So millennials, number one is volunteering, and number two is donating. And what's interesting is this aligns really well with some other research and other discussions I've had with folks that are looking at millennials, is millennials have a very different process, one on how they evaluate an organization and how they engage with an organization. What they'll do is they'll go to an organization's social media profiles to learn a little bit more about them. They want to see that you're real people. They want to see that you're human. If you have the same sort of corporate speak that you have on your website, they're probably gone. They're not even going to engage with you any longer. But if they like what you're saying on social media, then they're going to come in and volunteer. If the volunteering goes well, then they will make that donation decision. So it is a very different way. And really, organizations should be looking at getting millennials volunteering well before they even ask them for money, which makes sense if you think about it.
I wonder if millennials are telling us that they have more money than the rest of us, and their time is scarcer, which would... Well, I don't mind their time being scarcer, but if they have more money than the rest of us, that's annoying the hell out of me. if that's what they're saying. All right, we have just like a minute and a half before we have to wrap up. So let's just flush out a little bit more. We've already touched on this a fair amount, but the differences in engagement around age and generation.
Yeah, so that what I'd recommend is for folks to download the study, and they can do that at abila.com, abila.com/donor-engagement-study, and there they can see all the charts and dig deeper into the data. But we did find those very interesting differences, and you know, like I said, you got to take everything like this as a starting point. And then you need to test it and try it within your own organization. We brought up a lot of the ones earlier about direct mail and all that stuff. But another one I found really interesting on the differences was on gifts. Where is it? I'm looking at my data right here.
Well, Rich, we have to.
And I lost it.
That's okay. We have to wrap it up. But you've told people where the study is, and if they want more too, they can get you on Twitter at Rich Dietz. Rich, thank you very, very much.
Oh, definitely.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks a lot, Tony.
My pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Tony's Take Two and the Right Database are coming up. First, opportunity collaboration. It was a terrific experience. It really kicked us up to the next level. We built out a fund on site, and we have raised $2.5 million toward a target first close of $5 million from delegates at the 2013 collaboration. That's from Ross Baird, Executive Director of Village Capital USA. There are funders at Opportunity Collaboration, and there are also and impact investors, as well as lots of smart people from nonprofits. Opportunity Collaboration, a week-long unconference in Ixtapa, Mexico, for everyone who is working in or around poverty alleviation. Lots of people who can help you get your work done, and there's plenty of free time built in to meet those people, make friends, and figure out how you're able to help each other. I was there last year. I'm going this year. Every session is in a circle. It's very collaborative. No PowerPoints, no plenary speakers. 350 people from around the world collaborating. If your work is related to poverty, check it out. OpportunityCollaboration.net. We had a death in the Nonprofit Radio family. Rochelle Charette, the first guest on Nonprofit Radio to die. Rochelle founded Charcherette, a support network for breast cancer survivors. And very sadly, she's no longer a survivor. It was June 1st when she died. She was on the August 31st, 2012 show, and we talked about storytelling. And Rochelle very generously shared her story and story of lots of people that Charcherette has helped and worked with. My thoughts go out to her family and Charcherette and those tens of thousands of women and men that that her work has touched. I have a tribute video with a link to the show and also the New York Times obituary at TonyMartinetti.com. And that's Tony's Take Two for Friday, 19th of June, 25th show of 2015. Here is next segment, which is also from NTC, as many have been lately. Excellent stuff from the Nonprofit Technology Conference. Here is the Right Database.
Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of the Nonprofit Technology Conference 2015. We're hosted by N10, the Nonprofit Technology Network, in Austin, Texas, at the Convention Center. My guest is Michelle Chaplin. She is Senior Manager for Online Fundraising at PBS, and her workshop topic is how to choose the right database for your organization. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Thank you for taking time on a busy conference day. let's start with a threshold question. How do we know if our existing database needs to be changed?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And I think the first thing is you have to sort of go through the process as if you're looking to change your database. So first you want to look at all your current users and what their needs are, what they're trying to get out of the database, and what it doesn't do that they want it to do. And then you need to bring all of those questions to your current vendor and ask them, like, is this something the database really can't do? Or is this an add-on feature that we can pay for? Or is this, you know, a customization that we can get? Or do we actually have access to this all along and we just didn't realize it? And then you want to weigh, like, the costs of adding those features to your current database to the cost of switching and implementing a brand new database, which is, you know, substantial when you take in implementation costs, training costs, and just the time it's going to take for your staff to learn a new system.
How do we filter out when we're asking these questions in our organization between people just complaining about the database and really having a genuine need that isn't being fulfilled? Because lots of people have complaints.
Absolutely.
How do we filter out the mere complaints and sort them out from what is a real need?
Right. Well, and I think it's really helpful to build a requirements document, which is just a fancy technical word for a need to have list and a nice to have list. So you take all of the various rants and complaints and things they want the database to have, and you divide it into things that are real deal breakers, like your database is not going to work, your users are not going to get what they want without these things, and then the nice to have things, which, you know, might help you increase adoption, it might make a few people happier, but it's not going to make or break your database, and that's going to help you kind of narrow down your options.
Okay, so people will become more rational if we ask them to categorize between needs and desires?
Exactly.
Okay. We're trying to insert some rationality into this whole process, right? Be a lot more strategic and sophisticated. Okay. So then if we have our requirements document, most vendors are going to be willing to review this with us?
Yeah. And generally when you ask a vendor to present their database or their system to you, they probably have like a put together PowerPoint presentation. And I would say just send them your requirements, ask them point blank, like, does your system meet all of these requirements? If not, then they don't need to waste their time presenting or your time, you know, giving you this presentation. And when they present to you, ask them to just open up an example of their database and go through the steps that your users will go through so you can see what your user experience is rather than just getting kind of their standard sales pitch.
Okay.
And that'll save you both a lot of time.
Okay. Let's take a step backward. when you're talking to your existing provider. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of position it so that they don't feel like they're being threatened, or not threatened, but so that they don't just become defensive and, you know, oh, but you didn't identify that as a need years ago, or we didn't understand that that was a requirement of yours. You know, you're trying to cut through that stuff and just, can we get our needs met?
Right. Yeah, and I think it's a matter of, you know, acknowledging the fact that this process you're going through is a process that you've just started, and you're looking at the database and you're looking what people need to get out of it, and you're asking them, like, is this something I can do with the database? You know, because this is a new, like, need that has come up, or this is a new requirement that we've identified that's going to be necessary in the future. And, you know, most vendors will work very hard, and if at all possible, to keep your business.
Yeah, they're going to recognize why you're asking.
Exactly.
They're going to understand.
And, you know, if they can't do it, then it's sort of, you know, it's self-explanatory why you need to move on. And I think they understand that. Like, most vendors aren't going to throw a fit over, you know, you making a reasonable, logical choice that this isn't the right fit for you.
Okay. So let's jump back to talking to new potential vendors. Are you a fan of RFPs for this process? Or some people are, and some people think they're overblown and don't really accomplish very much.
I'm a fan of a super simple RFP.
Okay.
And what I do is my request for proposal are, here are my requirements. This is my requirements document, the list of need to have, nice to have stuff. And if your database can do all of my need to have and some of my nice to have, then I want to hear from you.
Like you said before.
Exactly.
That's a pretty simple RFP.
Yes.
Compared to many that we've all seen.
Exactly,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Because most vendors, they already have their standard product. They're not going to take the time to, you know, answer a custom RFP for every single client.
Right. Okay. That's the other side of one of the other disadvantages is you're going to not hear from a lot of potential vendors who just won't spend the time answering a lengthy RFP.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So what's our next step? How do we proceed in this process?
Yeah. So once you kind of have your short list of vendors and you've seen their presentation, then you really want to dig in and evaluate those, you know, top three or four vendors to really ascertain whether or not they meet your needs. And if they all meet your needs, like, what nice to have requirements do they also meet? That'll help you further narrow your list down. For this part, I recommend, like, actually doing trials of everything. And if a vendor won't let you try out their product and go in and mess around, I would be a little bit wary of that, because then you're, like, buying, you know, you're buying a car without giving it a test drive.
Yeah. So what do? Migrate just a part of your database into each platform that you want to test?
Yeah, or you can just create some sample data, or a lot of databases, if you're doing their trial portion, they even would come with sample data, so you can just play around with the way it exists and just go through a few of your processes. You know, there doesn't have to be, you know, huge reports generated or anything useful. It's just you need to be able to see if your users are going to be able to get what they need to get out of it.
All right. Yeah, please. Go ahead. More.
So then after that, you can just sort of rate the different options based on your criteria.
Yeah.
So your needs to have, obviously, if they don't meet any of the needs to have, that's a deal breaker. You can stop right there, throw them out, and take them off your list.
And they wasted your time because you asked them that originally.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So they more points they lose.
Right.
For squandering time. All right. Who's involved in this process from the organization? Now that we're out to the outside potential vendors.
Mm-hmm. I think there needs to be, like, a point person or a project manager who's doing the implementation. And really, that depends. Like, if it's a small organization, it could be just somebody with the title of project manager or executive assistant. Or, you know, it might be the CEO doing all of this by themselves. And then in bigger organizations, they probably have, like, a database implementation manager or an administrator who's in charge of all the databases who can kind of oversee. So it depends on the size of the organization, but really one person should take ownership of it, and then they can liaise and manage all the relationships with the key decision makers, like the CFO, the CEO, who are actually, you know, signing the checks, and then all of the different types of users, the power users who are going in and, you know, stretching the database to its limits every day, the people who may be like volunteers using it every so often, and then all of the managers and other people at the organizations who may not ever use the database but need information from it. So like your finance officers might need financial reports out of your database, but they don't actually go in and generate the reports.
Yeah.
So you need to talk to them too.
Do you think the board has a role here or not really?
I think it really depends on the board and the scope of the project that you're working on. So if it's a large, like if it's your, like a financial management database and the board, you know, is looking at the finances every quarter, hopefully, and is generating the reports, then I think including them in, you know, what they want to see in terms of those reports and making sure that the database meets their needs in that respect. And then on the other hand, if they're key decision makers in terms of this could be a very large purchase and they're, you know, key decision makers in terms of purchase decisions, then you need to be able to show them like this is the best option for our organization and why. And having that documentation of like these are our need to have, nice to have criteria and how every single option rates, then you'll get sort of like a clear picture of this is the winner, and it's something that's easy for them to digest and easy for you to sell to them.
Yes, and in large part because you're showing that you've done your due diligence when you can document the process that you've been through.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you for that digression. We were at the stage where we're testing. We've got sample data.
Yep.
And we're testing a few alternatives.
Exactly, and then it's just about going down your requirements document and checking off like every process you go through, everything that it can do, you know, all the little nice to have stuff that your users may want, but it's not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, grading those and using those to just rate your different options. And again, that's going to give you a clear winner. In fact, there's a really cool Excel spreadsheet, which allows you to do like weighting of your different options and your different criteria.
Yes.
And it gives you a numerical score for each of the vendors. So you can say whoever has the highest score wins.
And right, has the advantage of weighting, so everything is not equal.
Exactly.
But in reality, it's not. All right. What's our next step now? We've selected one, I presume. Are we at that stage where we've chosen one?
You've hopefully chosen wisely.
Yes.
And everyone's on board because you can demonstrate that
it's
you did your homework.
Yes.
And then it's time to make a plan. Like, this isn't the end, really. It's the beginning.
Yeah, what goes in our plan?
So this is
the transition plan?
Exactly. Okay. The implementation plan.
Okay.
And I like to start with kind of the end date. So when we want all the users to be able to log on to the database and use it, that's the kind of what I start with. And then I work backwards from that until I get to today. So maybe, you know, 3 to 4 weeks before the end date will be like the soft launch where our power users can go in and play with stuff and look at it. And maybe like a month or two before we'll do the data migration. And, you know, you just map it out, and going backwards until you have today where it's like mapped everything you have to do right now.
Okay. Let's spend a little time on migration,
because
that can be very, very messy.
Yes.
We should expect a lot of support from the new vendor in migrating data.
So that's going to be something that you have to consider in your requirements document, is how much support do you need to migrate your data? Do you have a lot of in-house expertise, or are you going to need full support? And is this new database something that, you know, your IT team or your in-house database experts can figure out and migrate your data into, or is it a proprietary software that the vendor has to do themselves? So that's definitely something you want to consider while you're looking at different vendors, what your need is in that respect. Another option would be hiring a third party or an external consultant to come and look at your current data, clean up your database, and migrate it over for you.
Yeah, this could be an opportunity to clean up your data.
Exactly.
Okay. Maybe you can include cleanup in the migration support that you get from the from the new vendor.
Maybe Absolutely.
Maybe we can build that in.
Yeah. I mean, just like every time you move your house, you kind of clean out your closet. Yeah. Every time you migrate your data, you want to think about cleaning it up.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag NonprofitRadio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, "Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office." Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there, too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
I'm Rob Mitchell, CEO of Atlas of Giving, and you're listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.
We need to be very specific, I would think, about what's going to be included in the implementation plan, that it be in the contract with the new vendor.
Yes, absolutely. And most vendors will build that in. Usually it's in like a number of hours that they'll offer in certain packages to work on data migration, on training, on support. And they're all, you know, most vendors will negotiate that with you depending on your organization's needs.
Okay. What's our next step now? We're past the timeline. Where are we now?
Well, hopefully you do everything on time, right? If your implementation falls on schedule, of course it doesn't,
yeah.
But...
it's an aspiration.
Exactly.
A lofty goal.
We're talking in hypotheticals, yeah. so we can dream. But even if not, you know, and plan for that in your timeline too, like plan for what happens if everything falls apart and we don't launch, you know, the database on October 1st. If we do it November 1st, like how much of a catastrophe is that? What about December 1st? You know, if it's a CRM and you're doing year-end giving, do you really want your database to launch on December 1st?
Yeah.
So, you know, planning for contingencies like that. But once you've gone through the timeline, once you've migrated your data over, you've gotten your staff trained on it, you know, your users are doing it, you're getting good user adoption, and really including them in the entire process, asking them what they want is going to be a big help to you in getting user adoption. Then, you know, it's about just maintaining your database and keeping the support going and keeping your users engaged and using it and making sure it's still doing what you're doing.
Is there much of a difference, and you're free to tell me that it's obvious either way, whether the new vendor trains just the power users, like train the trainers, or whether they should be training all the users?
Mm-hmm.
Does that matter?
I think
And then the trainers would train the lower level users.
Right.
Your internal trainers.
I think there's something to be said with training the trainers. You just want to make sure that you have enough to support your kind of lower level users so they can all get training quickly. And also, what if one of your trainers leaves? Do you have another trainer? Do you have a program for keeping that knowledge in-house? Or will the vendor continue to train people on an ad hoc basis afterwards? So, you know, it's just the benefits and risks of having some stuff done in-house versus everything done by the vendor.
Mm. Okay. And then, of course, ongoing support.
Yes.
Critical.
Well, it really depends on, again, your in-house expertise and how complicated the database is.
Yeah. I always think of smaller and mid-sized nonprofits because that's who our audience is.
Right.
So they're less likely, and certainly they could, but less likely that they'll have a lot of in-house expertise around database administration and day-to-day issues.
Mm-hmm.
So the support is important.
Yes, okay. Definitely.
We still have a couple minutes left. What do you want to share that I haven't asked you about yet?
Oh, goodness.
Or more detail on something, I mean, even if we talked about it, but any more detail?
I think one thing that we didn't really have a chance to go into in depth is the idea of hiring a consultant to do all this with you.
Oh,
because
yeah, good.
Especially if you are a small organization or even a medium-sized organization, you might not have a staff person with the time to do all of this research and, you know, talk to all the vendors and go through all the trial periods. And, you know, the advantage is if you do it with a consultant, you have them come in, they assess all your needs one time, they talk to all your respective users, bundle that. They already have a really good knowledge of all the different, you know, databases out there and how they would fit. So they'll know which vendors to go to, which are the best options probably in the first place,
mm-hmm.
and be able to pull it in and assess it, so you can kind of skip over the decision making, the research part, and go right into your short list where you work with a consultant to analyze the top three best fits, and they can make like the spreadsheet and analyze it and make it so you can, you know, defend it to your board and show that, like, there's, you know, research and due diligence was done. And that, you know, it's more expensive, but it's off your plate and it's off your staff's plate.
There could also be value in the consultant evaluating the state of your data.
Mm-hmm.
Someone objective who's not likely to say, oh, well, yeah, there's this problem in the data, but, yeah, we've figured out how to work around that, so it's not a big deal. When really it is a big deal because you have faulty data, you've just developed a workaround.
Exactly, yeah. And then they can also come up with strategies for cleaning the data or companies you may want to engage to help you clean your data up so it works for you the way you need it to.
What's been the PBS experience? Have you done database change?
We actually went through this process about a year ago. We were looking at changing our email marketing system, and we kind of went through the first step, did our needs assessment, talked to all the users, went back to our vendor, and they actually made a lot of changes and customizations to our existing system so it would meet our needs. And, you know, and now they're just a really strong partner, and they're consistently checking in with us to make sure the database is still meeting their needs. So it did a really, you know, we didn't end up changing databases, which saved me a lot of headache personally. And it gave us like a really strong relationship with our current vendor.
Have you had your session yet?
No, it's tomorrow at 3:30.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to ask if you heard of any disaster stories. Do you know of any migrations that went badly, conversions went badly?
I know of so many.
You do.
So many. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I proposed this session is because migrations often happen too fast without enough thought, and they end up just blowing up in people's faces. Nobody's happy with the end result, and they end up, you know, a year later after hobbling along with their new database, either switching back or switching to something different and completely. So I am looking forward to hearing a lot of horror stories tomorrow.
You expect to hear a good bit.
Yeah. Right.
But we can do this all much more strategically and smartly if we have this plan and process that we just talked about.
Absolutely.
And avoid being the next horror story at NTC 2016.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you very much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Michelle Michelle Chaplin is a senior manager for online fundraising at PBS. And this is Tony Martinetti, nonprofit radio coverage of the Nonprofit Technology Conference 2015. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks to everybody at N10, the Nonprofit Technology Network. Loved being at NTC this year. Next week, get your emails delivered. And did you know that there's a job called Email Deliverability Specialist? Also, the Open Movement. If you missed any part of today's show, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. Opportunity Collaboration, the world convenes for poverty alleviation, that outstanding unconference that'll ruin you for every other conference. OpportunityCollaboration.net. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Janice Taylor is today's line producer. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez, SusanChavez.com. And our music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about nonprofit radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. Yes. It was like, it was phone. This email thing is weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gifts.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperston.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.